The United States is in the midst of an energy revolution. Thanks to new technologies like hydraulic fracking, the United States has become the world's largest oil and gas producer. That has been good news for the energy business in the United States, but it has set off alarm bells among environmentalists. They worry that these developments are perpetuating America's dependence on fossil fuels and make it even harder to combat climate change. In 2016, Donald Trump traveled to Bismarck, the capital of North Dakota. It's one of the states that's been the biggest beneficiaries of the American energy revolution. Speaking at an oil industry conference, Mr. Trump gave the bullish case for American energy production.
America has 1.5 times as much oil as the combined proven resource, listen to this, as the combined proven resources of all OPEC countries. Think of that. We have more natural gas than Russia, Iran, Qatar, Saudi Arabia combined. We have 3 times more coal than Russia. Our total untapped oil and gas reserves on federal lands equal an estimated $50 trillion. Think of that. We're loaded. We didn't even know it. We're loaded. We had no idea how rich we were. We're richer than all of them.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Bob McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the challenges President-elect Trump will face after Inauguration Day on January 20th, 2017. On this show, we will talk about the issues that he will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about energy and climate change. How will President-elect Trump handle those priorities during his administration?
With us this week to help examine those priorities is Varun Sivaram, a senior fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Varun's also the acting director of CFR's Program on Energy Security and Climate Change. Varun, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Varun, let's get right to it. What are likely to be President-elect Trump's first steps on energy?
Donald Trump recently delivered a YouTube address direct to the people where he gave his priorities for his first 100 days.
On energy, I will cancel job-killing restrictions on the production of American energy, including shale energy and clean coal, creating many millions of high-paying jobs. That's what we want. That's what we've been waiting for.
It's likely that President-elect Trump in his first 100 days can accomplish the first part of what he promised, to remove restrictions on the production of energy. Whether he can accomplish the second bit, creating millions of high-paying jobs, is quite unlikely. But the first bit, to remove restrictions, probably will entail 3 actions. The first thing he'll do, I expect, is to repeal President Obama's moratorium or freeze on new coal mining leases on federal lands. The second thing he'll do is to expand oil and gas drilling areas on federal lands. Now, the most likely area that Republicans could focus on is in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. They also could focus on opening up new areas offshore, off the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. And the last thing that President-elect Trump could do, and this would be, again, purely based on executive action, he could make it easier to approve new pipelines and to streamline the permitting to get both existing and new pipelines to reality.
So Keystone Pipeline would be among them?
Keystone could certainly be approved. Same with the Dakota Access Pipeline, both of which are controversial.
Right. And he has said in the campaign trail that he will encourage, once he's in office, TransCanada to reopen its application for the Keystone Pipeline. But, Varun, can we start with the first point you made, which is making it easier for coal leases? And, you know, obviously during the campaign, Mr. Trump spent a fair amount of time in coal country, and he talked about bringing jobs back to coal country. And I guess the question is the problem that the coal industry is facing in the United States the result of federal regulation that has been strangling coal mines? Or is the case that coal mines and coal mining companies have been hurt by the fact of this energy revolution where hydraulic fracking has made it possible to really increase the amount of oil and gas production, particularly gas, which is a competitor to coal, and so the price of natural gas comes down, coal becomes less profitable, less competitive in comparison.
Exactly, Jim. It's the latter explanation. And frankly, it's a little irresponsible to conflate President Obama's policies on restricting coal mining with the economic effects, the reduction in gas prices that has made coal uncompetitive. It's not the case that coal companies are suffering because they don't have places to mine. Coal production is not dipping because there isn't place to mine. In fact, there are existing federal leases that could produce coal to meet U.S. needs for the next 20 years. It is rather that latter explanation you gave, that cheap natural gas is making it very difficult for coal power plants to compete in U.S. power markets around the country. And so that's not going to change.
So part of Mr. Trump's platform will actually intensify that problem because presumably he wants to make it easier for energy companies to drill for oil and gas, which will increase supply, which will, everything else being equal, tend to drive down prices, exacerbating the problem the coal industry faces.
Precisely. Not only will it drive down prices because it will make it, I think, marginally easier to produce more oil and gas, it could also reduce price volatility. So if you make it easier to permit a pipeline that, for example, takes gas to the Northeast, that could reduce the price spikes that the Northeast faces in the wintertime during gas shortage season. So if you reduce the volatility as well as the price of natural gas, you make it even harder for coal to compete in those regions.
So coal's not likely to be the beneficiary of Mr. Trump's, President Trump's policies, even though I suspect many people in American coal country think they'll be big winners.
You know, I think they may actually be winners, if not big winners. So we just talked about how low natural gas prices are not going away and coal will remain uncompetitive. But in addition, there are other policies that President-elect Trump could pass that make it slightly easier for coal to compete. Here are two examples. First, President-elect Trump could remove environmental restrictions on coal power plants. Currently, all coal power plants have to scrub their exhaust for poisonous sulfur dioxide and mercury. And if he takes those away, which, by the way, would be terrible for the local environment, coal power plants could survive longer than they're currently slated. They're currently slated for retirement in the next decade, many of them. The second thing that's even more important is President Trump could cancel the Clean Power Plan. This is President Obama's plan to reduce emissions from the U.S. electricity sector. And that Clean Power Plan would make it very difficult for coal plants to survive well into the future. So it seems as though under President Trump, the economics of coal are still going to be bad, but coal plants could limp along. They could be prolonged in their operation rather than retiring quite soon. And as a result, coal jobs may linger for a few more years than they might otherwise if President Obama's climate policies were continued.
But the coal industry is much less labor intensive than it historically was. Is that correct? I mean, my understanding was a lot of the newer technology in terms of mining for coal, strip mining, relies more on heavy equipment than it relies on large numbers of men going down into the traditional mine shaft that we think of.
Sure. So for mechanization as well as for market reasons, coal jobs are not coming back. And the best a President Trump can do is to prolong them a few years.
So that's an interesting point. I want to follow on that with the economics of oil drilling then. Mm. So we have, you know, oil prices are at a prolonged low. Some oil companies have decided they don't want to get involved in drilling offshore in some of the Arctic regions that they just see as economically not feasible for them or just really difficult. But President-elect Trump, he comes in first day and issues a number of these orders. Do you see a stampede or at least a rush to some of these to fill some of these leases and drill on federal lands?
No. The production volumes of oil and gas depend much more on market prices, like you said, the price of oil, than on the availability of land. In fact, President Obama recently opened up part of the Arctic Sea, the Chukchi lease block, and an oil company, Shell, explored the area, decided it wasn't worth its time, it was too expensive to extract the oil, and then retreated from that area. So I don't think it's the case that if Trump opens up lots of federal lands onshore and offshore for oil drilling, you're actually going to see a measurable increase in production. And we may actually see the effects of his policies 4, even 8 years down the road, maybe after he's out of office, when the full effects of increased drilling on new lands is finally realized.
Can I draw out an observation you just made, Varun, which is that energy companies, when you're thinking about drilling, whether for oil or for gas, are to some extent influenced by market prices of they can get for their product at the end of the day. And in the case of oil in particular, those prices are really set on a global scale because oil can be transported. I think gas is harder to transport from place to place. So I think the economics are a little bit different. Sort of can you give us your sense right now of sort of where global oil markets are in terms of prices? Is it going to be the case even if you open up more places to drill that companies might say, but just given the global price of oil, it's kind of low and we won't be able to make a profit. How do you expect that to net out?
Yeah, I mean, Jim, if there were a surefire way for me to lose my job, it would be to try and be an oil market prognosticator.
Okay.
So I don't want to.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you to predict oil prices. But again, a couple years ago, we were talking about $140 a barrel for oil. Today, it's down, I guess, what, around $50 or so. OPEC has often talked about reining in production, hasn't seemed to be able to do that. So let's just sort of stipulate, given sort of where the current market prices are, how attractive is it to energy producers to drill significantly more?
Yeah, there are kind of two extremes about how the oil market could unfold. On the one extreme, current low prices that have hovered at around $50 per barrel have discouraged a lot of new investment. And so the argument is down the road 5 years, because no one's put new investment to finding and drilling new wells, oil production could fall. And because supply falls, prices could rise and you could have a price spike. And so some folks are banking on prices rebounding to $100 or more per barrel in 5 years. And then the other, equally, in my opinion, valid narrative is we now have this new source of oil production coming from shale in the United States that's highly responsive to prices, because you can drill a well in less than a year and you can extract a lot of the oil from that well. So because of these highly responsive wells, you're not going to have massive shifts in the market from now on. These shale wells will be able to compensate for short-term market imbalances, and prices will continue to stay at this level because the market is quite responsive and non-volatile. So in either of these two cases, it's hard to adjudicate, you know, where in the middle we are. And I think as a result of the uncertainty, now is not a terrific investment climate for new oil drilling.
Okay, so at a minimum, you don't have an expectation that there's tremendous amount of pent-up demand and come January 20th, 2017, all of a sudden the wildcatters are going to be like running out into the fields to start drilling.
I don't.
So the other part of our conversation is about climate, and maybe to get there a little bit quicker, I wanted to ask you one more thing about energy, which is renewable energy. The extent I heard President-elect Trump talk about it, it was a bit disdainfully, partly to criticize the Obama administration. But can you talk a little bit about what we might see in the renewable energy front?
Well, I think we will see a continuation of the trends we've seen over the last 5 years. Renewable energy, in particular wind and solar power, and increasingly battery storage, have become extremely competitive. In many cases, wind and solar are cheaper than the alternative sources of energy, say natural gas or coal power. And so I think those trends will continue, because unlike volatile fuels, these technology costs decreases steadily over time. When you pay for a solar panel or a wind turbine, you pay for the whole thing up front, and then that cost is locked in. And the next wind turbine or solar panel you pay for is likely going to cost less, because the industry has learned from making wind turbines or solar panels along the way. So we can expect steady decreases.
Sort of like what
cost.
TV says, the prices
exactly.
have been down over time for high-definition television sets.
Exactly. We don't expect high-definition television sets to spike or double like oil might. And so moving forward, I think the economics will just get progressively better. I also think most policy on renewables is governed by the states, and I don't see a big state policy shift after this election. And the one federal policy that's important to renewable energy, the tax credits for wind and solar, enjoy wide bipartisan popularity, and they were passed in a bipartisan bill at the end of 2015. So I don't expect President Trump to roll them back.
Has President-elect Trump or candidate Trump talked at all about renewables and what he might do on that side, or is that sort of unknown for us?
Actually, candidate Trump did speak about renewable energy in his Bismarck speech, and here's what he said.
We'll get the bureaucracy out of the way of innovation so that we can pursue all forms of energy. This includes renewable energies and the technologies of the future. It does include nuclear and wind and solar, but not to the exclusion of other forms of energy and other forms of energy that right now are working much better. The government should not pick winners and losers. Instead, it should remove obstacles to exploration. Any market has its ups and downs, but lifting these draconian barriers will ensure that we are no longer at the mercy of global markets. We never want to be there again.
When you hear those words, Varun, what do you think that translates to in terms of specific policy initiatives that a President Trump might pursue?
Jim, you'll have to forgive me for being a little hopeful here. But my spin on this is President Trump wants to get out of the way of energy markets. And that means, you know, the current market trends in renewables will continue. He's not going to alter that in any way. But in addition, he expresses a clear desire for innovation. And I think that's very promising. This could be the one area that could enjoy bipartisan support in the energy and climate agenda, the need for new technologies in clean energy. And this transcends not just wind and solar, which are the traditional renewable energies that have enjoyed liberal support, but nuclear power, as well as carbon capture, sequestration, and utilization, ways to use fossil fuels, but in a clean way, and take the carbon dioxide that comes out and put it to useful use.
So on the climate front, candidate Trump talked about not funding UN climate programs, some of which the U.S. contributes to. He's spoken against the Paris Climate Agreement and is not seen as—
He said he was going to cancel it.
He said he was going to cancel it. He's not spoken as someone— in fact, climate, as we talked about in this podcast earlier, didn't get much discussion at all during the campaign or debates or what have you. But he is certainly— his expressed policies are not showing a great deal of concern about climate change. So any signals that this could roll back or how severely this could roll back where the Obama administration has been going on climate policy?
Yeah, in contrast to his moves on the energy market, which, as we discussed, aren't going to dramatically alter the state of play. On climate, if President Trump lives up to his campaign promises, it could be disastrous, both for the international efforts on combating climate change as well as our domestic efforts. And the two go hand in hand. So under President Obama, there were two major pillars of the U.S.'s commitment to reduce its emissions by 26% to 28% by 2025. That's the commitment we made to the world at the Paris Climate Change Convention in 2015. And those two pillars are, first, the Clean Power Plan to reduce emissions from the power sector, and second, CAFE standards, or corporate average fuel economy standards. This is to make our vehicles up to 54.5 miles per gallon efficient by 2025. Both of those policies, which together account for the majority of our emissions reduction plans, both of those policies are in jeopardy. The Clean Power Plan is almost certainly dead under President Trump, and CAFE standards are undergoing a review that President Trump's administration will oversee. And there's a strong possibility that if the auto lobbyists have their way, the strong fuel economy standards passed under the Obama administration could be rolled back.
So just I want to be clear. What is it that a President Trump can do because he is president, and what does he need Congress to go along with him to do?
Unfortunately, because so much of President Obama's climate agenda was passed by executive action because he foresaw a non-cooperative Congress, these actions are just as easy to roll back.
Okay, so what you get with the stroke of a pen, you could lose with the stroke of a pen.
Precisely. Okay. And so you can lose the Clean Power Plan. Legal experts will argue, but my opinion is you can lose the Clean Power Plan. You could lose CAFE standards, or at least the stringent ones we have today. And this is important for the original question you asked, Bob, about international climate progress, because if the United States doesn't meet its domestic target, and if it appears to be making no effort to meet that, then it's going to be very damaging to the credibility of the international climate process that the Obama administration helped spearhead. Trump has promised to try and cancel the Paris Agreement. Now, there are three ways that he could do that. The first way, legally dubious, but what they seem to be, the transition team seems to like the most, is to issue an executive order canceling President Obama's signature on the Paris Agreement. That would mean that, in effect, the United States never signed it and is therefore not bound
by it.
Well,
this is like with the unsigning of the ICC,
the ICC
we talked about.
Which happened at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. The second way that most folks envisioned was that President Trump would formally withdraw from the Paris Agreement. Now, the Paris Agreement has formally entered into force internationally, and so as a result, there's a clause that forces any country that withdraws to basically wait 4 years before it actually withdraws. That means President Trump's first term would be over. So that's what most climate advocates hoped would happen. But there's a third and even more dramatic way that President Trump could withdraw from the Paris Agreement, and that's to withdraw the United States from the overarching climate framework, the treaty signed in 1992. And if he does that, the United States will end all of its involvement in the international climate process and could leave Paris within a year. All of those three would be very damaging, obviously, to U.S. leadership on climate change, and they could damage the entire enterprise. The United States is the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, and our leadership, along with China's, has been crucial to get us to this point.
What about the aspect of, let's go back to markets a little bit in terms of how that might have some sort of effect, a counter effect. And one example of that is the CAFE standard. So, you know, the administration could indicate it's eager to just to roll those back. But say car companies, maybe some car companies, especially maybe non-American car companies, are finding themselves very competitive in that way, and that American consumers want cars with high fuel efficiency standards, and that they suddenly are the American makers might find themselves losing market share if they go back to previous standards. For that's just one example, but there could be others in that area where, you know, you could find, as in our coal discussion, that there actually are market forces that will that are maybe unforeseen but could actually have an impact on that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, that is a great narrative. Unfortunately, I don't think the data agrees with that. Ever since oil prices crashed, U.S. consumers have been buying less and less fuel-efficient cars.
Bigger and bigger.
Exactly. They've been
cars. I can't drive in a parking lot or park in a parking lot because I can't see over.
But the CAFE and the CAFE extended to light trucks and some bigger cars, right?
Yeah. The problem is the way that the CAFE standards are designed. It doesn't stop the American public from switching from passenger vehicles to light trucks, and in doing so, reducing the overall fleet fuel economy. And so as a result—
Because trucks, light trucks have different standards.
Light trucks have different rules, exactly. And so as a result, despite having risen through all of the entirety of the Obama administration, fuel economy fleet-wide in the United States actually dipped in the last year of President Obama's administration. And that's because of low oil prices. So American consumers actually are not displaying a willingness to buy fuel-efficient cars unless such a mandate is imposed on them.
Varun, I'd like to draw you out on the broader political and diplomatic consequences of a decision by the Trump administration to either reduce or entirely withdraw from this vast array of agreements and processes on climate change. Obviously, the Trump administration is doing this because Mr. Trump is skeptical of the argument that human activity is behind climate change, and he's been very vocal about that. For example, he told the Miami Herald in an interview in August 2016.
Well, I'm not a big believer in man-made climate change. There could be some impact, but I don't believe it's a devastating impact. I am a huge believer in clean water and clean air, crystal clean water and air. I'm a very big believer in that, and we have a lot to do with that, keeping our water clean, keeping our air clean. But no, I would say that it goes up, it goes down. I think it's very much like this over the years.
So do you see any significant diplomatic or geopolitical consequences of the United States turning away from climate change issues at exactly the time most other countries seem to be coming to consensus that action is needed to combat the production of heat-trapping gases?
I certainly do. I think under President Obama, climate change has become a central plank of our entire diplomatic agenda. I heard an anecdote that when President Obama meets with a foreign leader, unless climate change is on the agenda, he will not take the meeting. And as a result, climate change and our related conversations around, for example, clean energy, technology cooperation, have underpinned relationships that otherwise might have soured. For example, our relationship with China, over which we have tensions ranging from cybersecurity to sovereignty in the South China Sea, our relationship with China has been buoyed by our positive announcement on climate change. In 2014, President Xi and President Obama both announced their joint targets and their leadership of the climate process that led to Paris. Our relationship with India, similarly. We may have disagreements over trade with India, but every time that Prime Minister Modi and President Obama have met, they have made an announcement on climate change and clean energy. So I think that climate change has become a central element of our diplomatic agenda, and abandoning it and abandoning leadership after bringing the world this far is certainly going to make us look bad in the eyes of countries and relationships that we find important and make it more difficult to advance other parts of our agenda where we currently don't have as much agreement.
Do you anticipate that China is going to try to take the leadership on climate change? And if so, what might that look like? Would it be real or would it be substantive?
I think that is the question of the hour. Almost certainly China is going to seize the opportunity to take leadership. China is the world's number one emitter. But
not on a per capita basis, Chinese diplomats would point out.
Exactly. But in aggregate, they are the world's largest emitter. And next year, China will host two very important summits. The first is the Clean Energy Ministerial, where the biggest countries get together and figure out how to deploy clean energy. And the second is the Mission Innovation Ministerial, where, again, the biggest countries get together and decide how they can double their research and development budgets in the next 5 years. China, I believe, will assume leadership of both of these groups in the absence of the United States staking out its leadership claims. And China also, I think, is going to drive forward the international diplomatic process in the absence of the United States, especially if it leaves the Paris Agreement. Now, what does this all mean? The benign interpretation is that China will fill the void that the United States has left and, as a result, will continue to have climate progress. But the less optimistic interpretation is that, in fact, China will use its newfound leadership to drive deployment of clean energy toward its own purposes. For example, China wants to finance infrastructure along its One Belt, One Road initiative to extend its sphere of economic influence. Moreover, I believe China will shift focus away from the development of breakthrough new technologies and toward investment worldwide in incremental research, because that benefits China, which is the producer right now, the number one producer of solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries, a low-cost producer that does not produce innovative products. I think that plays to its strengths.
And meanwhile, we continue to hear reports about record-setting warm temperatures around the world. Any of those types of reports have any ability to sort of move the debate in the U.S. from your experience and seeing previous previous epic climate incidents or other types of things?
I would not expect scientific facts to move the public debate in the United States. It's unfortunate, but it's based on decades of political experience at this point. So unfortunately, I think we are locked into 4 years of limited visibility of the problem of climate change, at least from our administration. And in my opinion, the most we can hope for is, again, this bipartisan consensus that energy innovation matters not just for climate change, but also for U.S. advanced manufacturing jobs and U.S. competitiveness abroad, and that as a result, we really ought to be investing in new technologies and new industries at home if we're going to win this global clean energy race with countries like China.
And on that note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Varun, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob and Jim.
Pleasure to have you, Varun. Be sure to subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review while you're at it. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazu with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick, recording engineer John Fletcher, and with special thanks to Audrey Boulder. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the President's Inbox.